The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes. Back in 1999, I was visited here in Yellow Springs in the WYSO studios by an actress. Her name was Gloria Stewart, and she had just published her biography. It was called I Just Kept Hoping, and Gloria Stewart was in her 80s when she came out to see us. And she was living the high life because she had been in the movie Titanic, playing the role of Old Rose. Gloria Stewart was born on July 4th, 1910, and she died at the age of 100 on September 26, 2010. According to her Wikipedia listing, she was an American film and stage actress, visual artist, and activist, a native of Southern California. She began acting in high school in the 1920s and on the stage in the 1930s and 40s, and she appeared in movies like The Old Dark House in 1932, The Invisible Man in 1933, and The Three Musketeers in 1939. She made a prominent return to cinema when she was cast as the 101-year-old elder Rose Dawson Calvert in James Cameron's Titanic. Let's listen now to Gloria Stewart from the Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And it's my absolute pleasure to have on the program today Gloria Stewart. Her book is I Just Kept Hoping, and many of you have seen Gloria in a number of movies, including quite recently a film that I think a few of you have seen. It's called Titanic. Welcome to the program.
If a few of you haven't seen it, you're way behind.
Gloria, this is a wonderful book. You wrote it with your daughter.
I wrote it, every word myself. My daughter edited it. And if she were here with me today, she would say that. She's a professional writer. I have kept diaries since I was 14, and of course, a lot of scrapbooks when I was working in film. But I said to her, Sylvia, you know, I can get things mixed up and so forth. You know, I want you to edit every day. Tell me what you think I've written too much about, not enough about, so forth and so on. So she was my right and left hand and so forth. But I wrote every word.
I read every word.
Oh, you did? Oh, that's lovely. Because I've talked to a lot of interviewers, and most of them wave the book around and say, what a wonderful cover, but they haven't read it.
I was absolutely delighted to read it. You really opened the windows and let us look at Hollywood in the 20s. You let us look at Berkeley in the 20s. You let
exactly.
us look at Santa Monica before they got all built up.
Yes.
Brentwood before it got so developed.
Right.
It's an amazing tour of your life. Gloria, let's go back to the beginning and move forward. You were actually born in California. Now, not many people can say that anymore, can they?
Well, I was born in Santa Monica in 1910. My mother was born in Selma, California, which is in the great San Joaquin Valley. And my grandmother was born in Angels Camp in the High Sierras in California. So starting with me, there's three generations. Now, my daughter was born in Santa Monica. Two of my grandchildren were born in Santa Monica. Two of them, only one of them was born in England. I have three born in California. And now I have 12 great-grandchildren, most of them born in Southern California.
And even at a very early age, when you and your brother, boy, were
yes.
out and about, people would look at you and they would ignore your brother, and this trend continued, didn't it?
Yes, it did, and I guess it entered my subconscious that I was beautiful and desirable and so forth. You know, and for a child or a nubile young girl, this is not a bad thing. It gave me evidently, and you know, you bring up a point I hadn't thought about. It gave me probably great confidence and great desire to be proven to, you know, to show myself.
And we'll forget about political correctness, but you grew into quite a dish.
Oh, thank you. Yes, that was my line. And I asked James Cameron after the picture was released, because the original line that he wrote was, "Wasn't I a hot number?" And I said, "Oh, please, James, that is so vulgar. And I don't think old Rose would say that. And it's not of the period." He said, "What do you want to say?" I said, "Well, I don't know, but I don't want to say that." He said, "Be my guest." So I came up with, "Wasn't I a dish?" I wrote him later when the picture was released and said I thought I should get writing credit and a little more added on to my residuals. There's a little resistance there.
Gloria Stewart has joined us. Her book is I Just Kept Hoping, and we've just been hoping that you could come by and see us, and our dreams have come true today. You went to Berkeley.
Yes, you
went to school in Berkeley. And you have some wonderful stories in the book about being at Berkeley. And one in particular that I really was tickled by is the story where the police come and you throw a box out the window.
Sir, that's a story in my past that, well, it was fun and games all the way. Let's say it that way, but it's okay. There's more to my life than that little police episode.
But that was a wonderfully funny episode.
And I'm sure it was very common. I don't think it was an uncommon occurrence.
You ended up getting a break and becoming an actress in Hollywood. And in the 30s, you were considered by many to be one of the most lovely starlets in Hollywood. Tell us about those days. That was quite a time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, because talkies had only been in 2 or 3 years, and they were looking for actresses and actors who could talk and who were stage trained. And, of course, I had worked in the theater from the time I was in high school all through college, and then later my marriage, and then Pasadena Playhouse. So when I came onto the set in Universal, came into the company, they didn't have any what we called starlets, quote unquote. They had Boris Karloff. Starlet, he wasn't. And Lon Chaney. Starlet, he wasn't. So I was, there's a wonderful Yiddish word, macher, meaning important. I was a very big macher at Universal. I was the only female beautiful lady that they had. So they made a great big fuss over me. Unfortunately, they didn't have any scripts. They didn't have any directors. They didn't have any leading men like, for example, at Metro, they had Clark Gable and Robert Young and all the greats. And at Paramount, they had Maurice Chevalier, you know, and so forth. So that was unfortunate. But I was used to having people make a fuss over the way I looked. What I was interested in was the way I acted, the way I thought. And in the 30s, that wasn't terribly important up until the time of Mr. McCarthy. It was how you looked and what you accomplished professionally.
Now, your first husband was a sculptor.
Yes.
And he sounds like an amazing man. Your second husband also sounds like an amazing man. He was a writer, and he journeyed with you through this Hollywood period. And one of his best friends was Groucho Marx.
His best friend, not one of his best friend, and Groucho's best friend. They were a duo.
What was Groucho really like? Behind the man we've seen in film and we've seen on television, what was he really like? Was he a jovial guy? Was he?
Well, it's interesting because we were such close friends. We were always invited to his dinner parties. Groucho had not been had a formal education. He was in great admiration, had great admiration for writers, particularly writers. And always at his house, you met writers, G.B. Stern, so many New York playwrights, George Kaufman, Moss Hart, E.B. White, so forth and so on. So he was a very jovial host at those parties. He also loved his children very much. He had Miriam and Arthur, named after my husband, and was very devoted to them. And one of the problems with Grouch was some of the dinner parties, he would have the children. Well, you know, conversation among adults, particularly people in the theater, can be fly. You know, and there were always wonderfully scandalous stories or funny, dirty stories to be told. And Arthur and Miriam be sitting there, and we'd say, Groucho, tell him to leave. You know, it's time to go to bed. So we're like, no, he says, all right. So he was very paternalistic in that way. It's a wonderful story. I don't think it's in the book. His father was called Frenchie. He was Alsatian from Alsace-Lorraine. And Frenchie had been a tailor, and Frenchie had never really made it as a tailor. And so Minnie, his wife, and the boys, the Marx Brothers' mother, Minnie sent the boys out in vaudeville. But eventually, Minnie died, and Frenchie came to live with the boys one after the other. And one night at a dinner party at Groucho's, well, there were very important people, Charlie Chaplin, Segovia, the great guitarist, so forth. And I guess Groucho decided that Frenchie should have dinner in the kitchen. So about halfway through the dinner, Frenchie opened the kitchen door and said, "More meat or I'll come out." So, but you know, he was with Grouch and loved him, and paternally, Groucho was fine. He was very acerbic, I would say, generally speaking. I learned my lifestyle from Groucho. You know, don't take any sass. Don't be impressed. Don't pay any attention to people who say what they are and who they are and where they are and where they're going and so forth. You know, listen and watch and pay attention and then forget it, Charlie. And Grouch was like that. He was a very interesting man. And he loved my husband dearly. I would say about a month before my husband died of Alzheimer's in the nursing home, Groucho came in to see him and leaned over. And Groucho visiting was the only one my husband sort of recognized. He would hear Groucho's voice and he would start to smile. And Grouch leaned over and said, "Sheik, don't go before I do." But Groucho went before Arthur. But it was a lifelong friendship. And, you know, I had 40 years of laughing all the way.
You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO and my 1999 interview with Gloria Stewart. Gloria was born at 11 p.m. on the 4th of July, 1910, on the family's kitchen table in Santa Monica, California. Her father was an attorney representing the six companies, Chinese Tongs, in San Francisco. Stewart was a person who did a lot of acting early in her life and then took a long break and did more later. She had a career in early Hollywood in the 20s and 30s and then took about 30 years off. Early in her career, in 1932, the Western Association of Motion Picture Advertisers announced that Gloria was one of 15 new movie actresses most likely to succeed. She was named a Wampus Baby Star, along with Ginger Rogers, Mary Carlisle, Eleanor Holm, and others. Her career advanced when the English director James Whale chose her for the glamour role as a sentimental wife who winds up stranded among strangers at a spooky mansion in his ensemble cast, The Old Dark House, with Boris Karloff, Melvin Douglas, Charles Laughton,
and a score of other great actors, including Raymond Massey. We'll continue with my interview with Gloria Stewart right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO with my 1999 interview with Gloria Stewart. Gloria left Hollywood in the late 1930s. Her sculptor husband at the time, Gordon Newell, was unhappy with Hollywood life. He and Stewart separated amicably and divorced. In 1933, on the set of her film Roman Scandals, a comedy starring Eddie Cantor, Stewart met Arthur Sheikman, one of the movie's writers. They were instantly attracted to each other and married in August 1934. Early in 1939, Stewart and then-husband Sheikman spent 4 months traveling in Asia, Egypt, and Italy, then landed in France, just as France and the United Kingdom declared war on Germany. They appealed to the American consul, asking to stay. Sheikman is a war correspondent, Stewart is a hospital volunteer. The consul refused help and told them they had to return to the United States. They caught the SS President Adams, the last American passenger ship to cross the Atlantic, and arrived in New York City in September. Here's Gloria Stewart from The Best of the Book Nook.
Gloria Stewart has joined us. Her book is I Just Kept Hoping. You have wonderful accounts in the book of living in an area of Los Angeles where you were surrounded in this little community by all sorts of very interesting writers and actors. I think one of your neighbors was Robert Benchley.
That was the Garden of Allah.
That sounds like such an amazing place.
It was. It was the place to live. If you were not domiciled with someone or living, you know, had a house or something, to be at the Garden of Allah was a great privilege. And it was during the war years. I was den mother for Dorothy Parker and Robert Benchley and Edwin Justice Mayer and Natalie Schaefer, you know, the ditzy dame in Gilligan's Island. So many. Elliot Nugent, Bogey came in later because I was the only one who could cook. So we were all very friendly, very close. And my daughter, in her reminiscences, because she was the Garden of Allah child, you know, that everybody loved and who loved everyone, she has wonderful stories about the Garden of Allah. One of them, and I'm trying to think of the name of the actor who had the wonderful bust in bronze. Do you remember the name of the actor? Well, he was a very famous character actor. He had a new bust made of himself in bronze, and he used to lie on the pool, by the pool, and dip the bronze bust into the pool. And Sylvia came back to our villa one day, and she said, it makes it more bronzy. It makes it more older, Mother. It was John Carradine.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
John my. Carradine. But, you know, there were wonderful stories like that.
Oh, my.
A lot of changing partners.
Uh-huh.
Dorothy Gish, Louis Calhern, his ex-wife, Natalie Schaefer. There was a lot of that going on, and it was very interesting. But the main thing about that period was, and the 30s, we kept our mouths shut. We all knew everything, all the shenanigans, but we kept our mouths shut. It was nobody's business. But the, what should I say, the protagonist, Luella Parsons, Hedda Hopper, Jimmy Fidler, Walter Winchell. It was common knowledge in the industry, but it was never printed. It was never put on the air. And, of course, there was no television. So that I regret. That a sense of privacy and that you could trust your friends and the press and so forth. I regret that because it's not possible today.
This was the same media that understood not to photograph the president in his wheelchair.
Exactly.
Gloria Stewart has joined us. Now, right before this period, you and your husband had incredible timing. You went on a work. right before the outbreak of World War II, and that sounds like such an incredible experience.
Well, we were both very political, so we had been following Mr. Hitler. My husband was Jewish, and I was working very hard to get emigres out of Germany with other people like Dorothy Parker and so forth. Both our contracts ended in February. Hitler had already moved into the Sudetenland, and he was talking about Poland and Alsace-Lorraine and so forth, and Churchill had become prime minister and was saying, you know, one more move and we will go to war. The French, with Daladier and the rest of them, were knuckly under to the Hitler threat. Mussolini was making a lot of noise in Italy, had already conquered Ethiopia and so forth. And my first husband had said to me, Gloria, when we were together, he said, Gloria, before you die, you have to see Angkor Wat in French Indochina. So I said to Arthur one day, look, we're both finished, Charlie. Name wasn't Charlie, but, you know, it's a sweet term. Let's go around the world. He says, great. When? I said, well, next Sunday. He said, well, whenever. So I was in charge because he had always said to me, you take care of the money. You make the arrangements. He never got theater tickets. He never did anything like that. Baseball, nothing. I did all that. So he was a writer and a dreamer. So, okay, we left in about 2 weeks. And I must say, Groucho and all our friends says, you're going around the world. And you didn't fly in those days. You know, you went by ship. We had something like 29 pieces of luggage, you know, backgammon sets, jewel cases, hat boxes, shoe boxes, 2 typewriters, so forth and so on. We took a freighter out of San Francisco, Tokyo, Japan, Shanghai. The Japanese had occupied China by that, almost, and they were outside the international settlement. Hong Kong, which had one hotel, the Peninsula, and believe me, if you want to go to a dull hotel, go to an English hotel with only Englishmen. And it was really dull. So I said, let's get the hell out of here and go on to Saigon, the French, you know, great. So we did. We went to Saigon. We hired a car, guide, drove to Angkor Wat. Then from there, you know, we went on to Bali, so forth, India, Egypt, and so forth. And we were in France when the war started. It was the most perfect timing because Bali, one hotel, no tourists. Angkor Wat, no tourists. Singapore, no tourists. India, no tourists. Egypt, no tourists. We were the last two people around the world. And so we saw it purely as it had been for centuries, French Indochina. China, Japan, so forth. And it will never be like that again.
My guest is Gloria Stewart. Her book is I Just Kept Hoping. And it's really great to be able to look through your eyes and to experience this lost world of Indochina and all these other places where you went. And you end up in Europe, and the war is really starting to get rolling. And you were hoping to do a film in England. And things just didn't work out, and you ended up going back to the U.S.
Oh, the wonderful cable that my agent in England sent me. I was supposed to make a film where an American girl is engaged to a British naval officer. So we're stuck down in the south of France, and the war has started. And we can't get to England. We can't get back to Egypt. We can't get to the United States. We're stuck. And I got a cable from him, Christopher Mann. He said, Dear Gloria, contract canceled. British Navy busy elsewhere.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 1999 interview with the effervescent Gloria Stewart. And Stewart had a long career as an actor, and she also did many other things, including designing books. She wrote the text, often poetry, set the type, carefully selecting the style of type to match the subject, printed the pages, then decorated the pages with watercolors, silkscreen, decoupage, or all three. She created large artist books and books in miniature. Several of her books took her years to create, and her books are in many museums. She's very well known, along with her paintings. She did
primitive paintings, and they are in museums around the world. What an amazing, remarkable life. I'll bring you my final segment with Gloria Stewart right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 1999 interview with Gloria Stewart. And Gloria was a painter, a book designer, an actor, an environmentalist. She had many interests. And one thing that she was known for was growing trees, bonsai trees. In the late 1960s, she embraced this art form. She took classes, and some of her trees are in the bonsai collection of the Botanical Gardens of the Huntington Library in San Marino, California. What an amazing woman she was. Here's Gloria Stewart, recorded in 1999.
We could talk all day, but I know that we're limited on time, Gloria, so I guess we need to move up to the next decade of the 50s. And this is when you're in New York, correct?
Yeah, well, the 40s I was in New York.
Okay.
Well, we went back to the 50s twice when my husband had plays to go on.
Okay.
And, yes.
And you had always dreamed of being a stage actress. And you did have that opportunity, didn't you?
Well, I tried and I tried and I tried. And all my friends who were playwrights and so forth, I read for them. It seemed at that time, which is exactly the opposite today, they didn't want movie actresses. And I lost a part with Franchot Tone and the Theater Guild. The only, because I was a movie actress, the only great bright spot was I played Emily with Thornton Wilder. He played the interlocutor, and I had 3 wonderful weeks with him in summer stock, with my husband and Thornton arguing about whether or not James Joyce was garbage or not. That's all they talked about for 3 weeks.
After your husband passed away, Arthur, you found a wonderful man several years later named Ward.
Richie
Ward. And
Ward Richie.
Ward Richie, I'm sorry.
Yes.
And you have a very artistic side. You were into all types of art things. And
yes,
when you met him, you discovered a new passion. And this just sounds like an astounding art that you were creating. You were making books.
What was the wonderful thing about it? When I found that I was no longer desirable as an actress, I started painting, and I had great success, a one-woman show at the Hammer Galleries in New York, and I showed all over the United States. And just about that time, Ward Ritchie, who had been my first husband's best friend, and we'd always liked each other, he came back into my life, and he was a world-famous graphic designer and printer and bookman, bibliophile. And he taught me how to print. So all the things that I'd been doing, like silk screen, painting and so on, the precision, the very, very fine handwork and so forth, all came together. And my books now, the Getty Museum has a complete collection in its special collections. Princeton University just bought my books. The Library of Congress, the New York Public Library, the Los Angeles Public Library, special collections, the Huntington Museum, special collections. So I've had great success. It's been since 83. I'm printing now. I'm going home and finish 2 books, one of Christopher Isherwood and one, it's James Cameron's acceptance speech for the Academy Award for Titanic. So that's what my life is now, except I make movies once in a while.
And I should note that Christopher Isherwood was a friend. Gloria Stewart has joined us, and I'm looking at the clock, and I know everyone's been waiting. We want to hear about Titanic. Okay, we're there. Tell us the story about how this all happened, about how you got this phone call.
Right?
Tell us.
Well, being a printer and having a studio out in the garden, I don't answer the phone because it's disruptive. And when you're printing and the ink is on the press and you're setting type and so forth and so on, you don't want to be bothered with, you know, all your friends wondering what you're up to and would you. So I didn't go in until about 5:30 that night. And there was this thing, this is Mally Finn, casting director for Lightstorm Entertainment. James Cameron is going to make a movie, Titanic. There will be location trip to Poland. I thought, why Poland? You know, why couldn't it be Italy? Could I see you? Are you interested? I didn't know from Lightstorm. I didn't know from James Cameron. Titanic, okay, you know, another movie. So anyway, I called Marvin Page, who has been casting director for General Hospital 100 years. I said, Marvin, listen to this. So he did. He said, Gloria, he said, James Cameron is one of the hottest directors. Terminator 1, Terminator 2, Lightstorm's a big studio. Titanic is a big budget film. He said, sounds great. Why don't you see what they have for you? So I called and said to Mally Finn, thank you very much. Yes, please come over tomorrow. And she did. Talked to me for about an hour with a video camera on her assistant's thing.
First time you'd ever seen one.
I'd never seen one. That's all right. You know, as you can tell, I like to talk, and I'm not camera shy. So she left after about an hour. That was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She called back and about Lightstorm is only 15 minutes away from me, the studio. She called back in about 45 minutes and said, could we send a script over? Well, I didn't know this. Cameron had seen a laser disc that I had made of the old Dark House, so he knew I could talk. He'd seen me in film, although it was in the 30s. But anyway, so I said, sure, she sent it over. Okay, you know how actors read scripts. You look for your part. Hey, that's okay, that's a good speak. Page after page. That's not bad either. More pages, you know. So at the end of the script, you know, in like 15 minutes, I knew I had there was a great part there, old Rose. So she called back and said, Mr. Cameron wonders if you would read for him tomorrow. And I said, oh, yes. I said, oh, Mrs. Finn, this is the most wonderful part. This is what I've waited for all my life. It's just beautiful. I said, you know, why me? And she said, well, he's looking for an actress in the 30s who would not be recognizable under 101-year-old makeup, which Katie Hepburn would have been, you know. And she said, he would like you to read for him tomorrow. And I said, oh, I would love to. Oh, I could taste this script. So then she called back in about half an hour, and he evidently then had seen the whole video thing. And she said, Mr. Cameron wonders if you would read for him without makeup. And I started to say my Groucho training. I'd read for him without makeup on if he wants me to. And then I thought, no, I better not say that. Without clothes on, if he wants me to.
Right.
And then I thought, I better not say that because I don't know her, I don't know him. I said, oh, yes, I would love to. She said, he's not sure whether you'd look 101 under the makeup. And so he came in the next morning at 10 o'clock. I didn't sleep all night. I was so excited. And he was very low-key, very gentlemanly, very soft-spoken. He had a video camera. So he said, I want you to read the script with Mally. So he sat, and this is all in my bar. He sat, and, you know, the thing went, and I read with Mally. He only stopped me once. He stopped me on the speech. There were 1,500 people in the water, 10 boats. Only one came back. And I read it with some anger. And he said, wait a minute. He said, why are you so angry? And I said, well, this is not permissible. This is impossible. I said, this is immoral, unmoral. He said, oh. I said, how do you want me to read it, Mr. Cameron? He said, no, that's all right. You feel that way, that's all right. He said, I didn't really write it. I said, how did you write it? I said, Mr. Cameron, I was married to a screenwriter. I've read 1,000 scripts, so I can ask you, what did you have in mind? He said, no. He said, that's fine if that's the way you feel it. So then, you know, finished. He said, thank you very much. Went off.
I'm looking at the clock. I know you have places to go and things to do. I need to tell you, you really make that movie. You are incredible in that role. And your narration is wonderful throughout
the
film.
Thank you so much.
It's just an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I've told you were a very erudite, wonderful interviewer, and they weren't wrong. They could have been, but they weren't. That's a plus. I'm very grateful.
Well, I have to pay a lot of people a lot of money to say that I'm erudite. but thank you.
You have a price?
I'm just kidding.
Sir.
I think interviews like these are actually priceless. Gloria, really hope you enjoy your book tour. And
I will. I'm going to be talking tonight and answering questions. Have you time to know what the first two questions will be?
Oh, let's see. The first question is probably, is James Cameron a nice guy? I don't know. What is it?
Why did you throw the diamond into the sea? And the second one is, are you alive or dead at the end? I'm not answering it on this program.
You have to come to the book signing to get the answer to that. I highly recommend the book. I really enjoyed it, and it's a wonderful view of a lot of different, very interesting times in this century. And the fact that you were born before the Titanic sank.
After.
You're born
after. Oh, that's right, before 1910 and 1912. You're so right, yes. People ask me, I remember the Lusitania.
Uh-huh.
I was four. Uh-huh. You know, German sank, passenger ship, hundreds drowned. It got us into the World War. So that I remember, the Titanic, I don't, I was only two.
Well, I must commend you. You have a phenomenal memory. You really do.
Well, thank my mother and my father.
Thank you, Gloria.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was Gloria Stewart talking about her memoir, I Just Kept Hoping, recorded back in 1999. Gloria went on to live to be 100 years old, and she was a lifelong Democrat. In 1938, as a member of the Hollywood Democratic Committee, Stewart was on the executive board of the California State Democratic Committee. She was also a breast cancer survivor. She was diagnosed when she was in her 70s, and she was treated, and it did not return. And she had quite a life and quite a career, and it was really a treat to meet her in person. In the Book Nook, when she came out to see us in Yellow Springs, and we have a little bit of extra time here this morning. I'm going to bring you a Book Nook bonus, and here is what it is. Back in the day, over 20 years ago, I had a guest on the program who was a former president of the National Rifle Association, and he was someone who I'm sure knew Gloria Stewart, the actor Charlton Heston, the late Charlton Heston. Well, now I have just heard that one of my former guests on the program has been named as the new president of the National Rifle Association. That would be Oliver North, who became a household name in the 1980s for his role in the Iran-Contra scandal. He will become the next president of the NRA. And North is 74 years old, a former Marine Corps lieutenant colonel. And back in 2003... I interviewed Ollie North for his book, The Jericho Sanction, and we recorded this interview. He was on a bus in Virginia going down the highway talking on his cell phone. Here's Ollie North from the Best of the Book Nook.
Let's talk about the protagonists in this new book, The Jericho Sanction.
Sure. Peter Newman is really a composite. The reason I write myself into these books is because a lot of people suspect that Peter Newman is really an allegory for Ollie North. Well, I've had a remarkable life of great adventure, and I've got the advantage over other people who write thrillers that, unlike most of them, I've actually done this stuff. I've been there, done that, as we say in the Marines, and I don't have to pick up the phone and call some expert and ask him for the cyclic rate of fire for the Golf 240 machine gun.
Mm.
And that gives me a certain advantage in writing these kinds of books. These are the kinds of people, Peter Newman and the like, the other characters in this book are the folks that I have spent my life with. And I have enormous admiration for them and wanted to give them at least some acknowledgement while they're still alive. But since I signed all kinds of non-disclosure agreements, if I were to write non-fiction about these guys, Vic, I'd have to send it to the government for clearance, and you and I would be great-grandparents before the government granted clearance to talk about these things. So what I've done is change the dates, times, places, and names enough that it's not going to compromise national security and really put the real stuff that a lot of real people really do, and they know who they are. And I think the American people who read these books get a sense for the remarkable courage and perseverance of the kinds of folks like Peter Newman that we've got out there serving our country. The bottom line of this whole adventure series is the kinds of terrorism we're up against needs to be dealt with. It's not an issue that, you know, we can pull out tomorrow out of Iraq just because there's been some casualties. My heart goes out to every Marine and soldier's family that has suffered a loss over there, but failure is not an option in Iraq. And so my encouragement in these books and others is to make sure that we persevere in this fight, because we've now won the war, and all we've got to do is secure the peace.
Where are the nuclear weapons? Do you think they got sent into Syria?
Well, I think Saddam, I mean, look, there's no doubt Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. The proof of that is irrefutable in the mass graves that have been unearthed since we've been there. And there are tens of thousands of people that were killed by Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. We know that he was trying to build his own nuclear weapons. And I think it's entirely possible that some of those nuclear weapons that we know are missing from the former Soviet arsenal may well have made their hands into the likes of the characters that are in this book. So regardless of what name you attach to them, it's a very, very plausible scenario. What's he really done with them? We're probably not going to know for months or years ahead, but I have no doubt we're eventually going to find out. Because we know that he had them. It's just a matter of what he's done with them.
Do you think he's still alive?
Don't know. And, you know, about half the guys I talked to over there, the folks in SEALs and the Army Delta people and the Marine Recon guys that I talk to on a regular basis and that email me regularly, about half of them think he was killed probably at some point during the war, and the other half are pretty sure he's still alive.
You've got a villain in your book who's a Soviet intelligence guy, and I can tell you had a lot of fun writing this particular character.
Well, he happens to be very, very close in parallel to a very real Soviet clandestine agent from the KGB. You know, there's actually two Soviet intelligence services. The KGB was officially dissolved when the Russian Republic was created. They now call it the SVR. But the GRU, the Soviet Military Intelligence Service, has never been disbanded. And many people regard that to be even more effective and more vicious than the KGB ever was. So Komolnikov, who's a part of this book, is very much a very realistic character.
And you also have a Ukrainian arms dealer. And this guy gets around.
Well, Dotensk, you know, one of the things that we've noticed, you know, in our intelligence services, such as they are, and there's a fairly strong indictment of the CIA in this book, because not because we don't have good clandestine services officers, we just don't have enough of them. And they've been restricted from doing the kinds of work that they need to do. One of the things that we do know for sure is that a lot of the former Soviet republics, which had KGB officers like Dotensk in it, those guys are now freelancers, providing arms and munitions to just about anybody in the world. And there's some even contemporary books, nonfiction. Robert Baer, who has written the book See No Evil, has a new book, Sleeping with the Devil, describing some of the people who you'd say, by golly, that's where Alan North got Dotensk. Bob Baer and I have known each other for a long, long time, and he was one of the finest clandestine services officers the CIA ever had.
My guest is Oliver North. His new novel is The Jericho Sanction. Did you ever think in your wildest imagination that you would be a novelist?
Well, you know, I guess everybody, Vic, who's done some writing, and I write a weekly newspaper column, I write all my own scripts for war stories on the Fox News Channel, I think anybody who writes for a living always kind of fancies themselves to have the great American novel, you know, tucked away inside. And I kind of tinkered with the, if you get a copy of Mission Compromised, the first of this trilogy, I'd wanted to write about those kinds of events that are in there for a long time. And when I was approached by Broadman and Holman to, have you ever thought of doing a novel? I said, well, as a matter of fact, I have. I sent them that first chapter of Mission Compromised, and they jumped on it and said, by golly, fill out the rest of it. So we're now on book two of a trilogy.
And the third book, obviously you're keeping some of these characters alive for.
Well, I don't want to give away too much of the ending of the Jericho Sanction, but let's just put it this way. The third book is going to be a very, very exciting book. It's already tentatively titled The Assassins.
Okay.
And it deals with the issue of combating terrorism and the steps America is going to have to take at some point to deal with this.
Speaking of steps, we went into this Iraqi thing basically with one major ally, the British. Do you think that we will continue to go it alone? Do you think that's the way that we should pursue this course, or do you think we should bring in the United Nations or other people, other countries to help us? What do you think about that?
Well, Vic, as you know, today there's talk about, you know, trying to entice the United Nations into this. Quite frankly, I don't find the United Nations to be particularly effective at combating terrorism. Now, they can't even define the word. And so getting help from the United Nations on dealing with problems the likes of which we face today in Iraq might be a great way to hand out assistance and humanitarian aid, but it's certainly no way to fight a war. I mean, this is the same United Nations that a month ago turned down what they called CF, that's Coalition Forces Protection, for their headquarters in Baghdad. And then they were shocked and surprised when it got blown up by a bunch of jihadists, who, by the way, were probably financed by the Saudis. And it was very likely either Syrians or perhaps Jordanians, maybe even Saudis, who were driving the truck that blew those guys up.
Let's look at some of these other countries in this area. You just mentioned Saudi Arabia. We have a fairly close connection with Saudi Arabia. We consider them to be allies, yet it seems that a lot of these terrorists are originating in Saudi Arabia. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, Vic, I want to take you back to 9-1-1-0-1. 15 of the 19 that seized four airplanes and flew them into the World Trade Center and his Farmers Field in Somerset, Pennsylvania, were from Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And all over Saudi Arabia today, you've got young men being taken aside and taught how to hate, how to kill, and how to kill themselves, trying to kill you and me. That does not sound to me like a friendly government. And yet all of these madrasas operate with the financial support of the royal family and the oil sheiks that are in the country, and quite frankly, running the country right into the ground. One can come up with a scenario that's not very promising for the royal family of Riyadh. And quite frankly, if there is a democracy in Baghdad, as I predict there will be in the not-too-distant future, that's a real threat to regimes from Riyadh to Oman to Damascus to Cairo to anywhere else in that part of the world, to include Tehran. Because if democracy works in Baghdad, people are going to begin to ask, why isn't it working here in my Arab country?
Did you mention Pakistan on that list?
Pakistan could easily be included. In fact, Pakistan's an even bigger issue, because Pakistan is not only not a democracy, but it, we know, has nuclear weapons.
And a guy who's in charge who we're not real sure of. Didn't he support the Taliban in some way?
Well, he himself did. I mean, General Musharraf, who is, you know, running the country today, took power in a coup over those who had been actively supporting the Taliban. Unfortunately, even though General Musharraf purports to want to bring about a democracy there, he knows that his country is very much subject to the will and whim of radical Islamicists who believe in the jihad against the West, and he knows he's got a deeply penetrated intelligence service that was very active in supporting Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda organization.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, recorded back in 2003, talking about his second novel, The Jericho Sanction. And I thought it was interesting to hear that after all these years. And he was talking about how we're going to find those weapons of mass destruction. We know they are there. We're going to find them. And it was just fascinating to hear that. And he has just been named the new president of the National Rifle Association. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. Tune in for the Book Nook tomorrow at 10:30 on Sunday morning. My guest will be Pam Wexler. We'll be talking about a murder mystery involving the Boston Red Sox. It's called The Fens.